Hello, this is Mark Shenton, welcoming you to a critical discussion of three productions, each of them new in their present form, but all of which are plays that have been a long time in the making. First, at the Old Vic, artistic director Kevin Spacey returns to National Anthems, a play that he first encountered over 16 years ago when he replaced Al Pacino to star in a regional US production at New Haven's Long Wharf Theatre in 1988. But Donald McIntyre's play about the clash of American values when an upwardly mobile couple move into a Detroit suburb and meet one of their neighbours for the first time has actually been kicking around even longer than that. The playwright began it as a one-act student play some 41 years ago. In the 26 years between beginning it in that form and his death aged 47 in 1990, he saw it performed in endless readings, workshops and regional US productions, the inevitable fate of many new American plays that get workshopped to death. Now McIntyre's ambitions for the play are only being realised from beyond the grave, as Spacey offers the play its highest profile outing yet and stars in it again himself, making his Old Vic acting debut since taking over the theatre. Next, at the National's Cottesloe, director Katie Mitchell has exhumed August Strindberg's rarely produced 1902 play, A Dream Play, relocated it to Britain in the 50s, and commissioned a new version by Carol Churchill that was then used as a springboard to which other new material was added during rehearsal. Mitchell has said that there was one overriding aim to the work, to try to make the production as close to a dream as they possibly could, and any text that got in the way of that idea was gently excised. The play has therefore become the story of the dreams and nightmares of a stockbroker, Alfred, played by Angus Wright, after he falls asleep while working late in the office one night. Mitchell credits the result to her acting company's efforts. She says the biggest credit for the process and the performance must lie with the actors whose imagination dominates the work. Finally, Days of Wine and Roses is a new stage version by Irish playwright Owen McCafferty of J.P. Miller's story, charting the fast rise and slow fall of a couple's relationship fueled by alcohol. First written as a teleplay in 1958 and subsequently rewritten for a big screen version in 1962 that starred Jack Lemmon and Lee Remick, is now set over an 8-year period in the 60s with the couple, now a bookmaker's clerk and civil servant, who meet at Belfast Airport just as they're about to set off to a new life in London. They are played by Peter MacDonald and Anne-Marie Duff in Peter Gill's production. With me to discuss whether new life has been breathed into these old vehicles are the critics Matt Wolfe, Kate Bassett and David Benedict. Let's begin with National Anthems, which, after Spacey's own directorial debut at the theatre with a poorly received new Dutch play called Cloaca, seems to have led to some concern for the direction and future of his fledgling regime at the Old Vic. Do you think, David, that those concerns are warranted?
I think the concerns over Kevin Spacey's season probably are warranted in terms of choice of material. What the Old Vic is managing to do is continually grab headlines from hungry newspaper editors that are very keen, seemingly, to pick over the traces of absolutely every decision that gets made in that building. So there's already been noises about the fact that he's going to do Richard II next, with Trevenan directing, and then the Panto, that was very financially successful, if not artistically, will be returning this Christmas as well. I don't think, however, that National Anthems is going to do anybody any favours, other than the actors, who all perform really impressively and make the best out of a bad job, I think.
Matt, with the American flag draped over the stage before the play begins, and even the chaser lights of the theatre canopy outside blinking in red, white and blue, the play as a metaphor for the state of America is rather rammed home. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I mean, it's not the subtlest image to begin a play with the American flag kind of staring you in the face. On the other hand, Bob Crowley's set a few seasons ago for Morning Becomes Electra had a sort of tattered American flag as its ceiling, as I recall. So it's hardly the first time. I don't think this is a very good play. I'm not sure it's as quite as bad a play as it's been made out to be. I thought it was infinitely more interesting than Cloaca. And it's a much, much better production than Cloaca. I actually think David Grindley, the Englishman who directed it, has done a beautiful job, and I thought all three actors were extremely good.
What is your opinions on the play, Kate?
I think it sounds as if we basically agree. I mean, I think it's a piece of excellent performances. I mean, almost impeccable performances by three actors. And I think the play lets it down quite badly. I mean, I think if you saw the play in a different context, you would think it was fine. You know, for an early play by someone, you know, it's quite strongly structured. It's not irrelevant. I mean, I think the American flag and the whole allegory of America is overstated, and I don't think it quite lives up to that. But, I mean, you could read persistent allegories into it about sort of American aggression and xenophobia that's all underlying the plot, where basically a stranger visits a couple of higher class and it ends up in a sort of vicious fight. And I don't think it's irrelevant in terms of it's really about materialism and class, and that's But, I mean, I sort of think that's as relevant to here as to America. I don't think it's particularly hugely about America. So I think the massive flag at the start is rather misleading and exaggerated in what it suggests the play is.
It strikes me as rather a small play that's kind of been overblown in the current setting. I mean, perhaps if it was down the Donmar Warehouse or a smaller fringe setting, it might work better. What do you think, David?
I think that is true context is all, whoever said that. On the other hand, I do think that you can't blame it entirely on where it happens to be happening and the spotlight that's being perhaps unnaturally thrown on it. This is a domestic drama that calls itself national anthems. McIntyre's decision about that is, you know, literally all over the text, and he does go for the jugular with lines like, "That's the great thing about this country. You can never get out of debt, but you can always invite people over." You know, he's absolutely got a focus on, "I want to make a big statement about this country and the state that it's got into in the greedy 80s." But I think that there are much better satires on the greedy 80s, notably in fiction, in Jane Smiley's novel Good Faith, and even Bret Easton Ellis's American Psycho. They kind of do that anatomization of America much better. This seems so contrived at various points. You know, this is a play in which the outsider comes in, staple form of drama, and the outsider comes in, and there are points at which you think, why didn't they tell him to get lost? The contrivances around keeping him in there for this play that's in 90 minutes of real time, in which they seem to get terribly drunk without drinking very much. I wonder whether they've put an interval into this play so that you sort of don't notice the fact that it builds up to this supposedly big cathartic finish. So that the audience perhaps, yes, can get drunk, but also so that the characters, you sort of forget that they haven't drunk that much. They seem to get very outlandish, and the big revelations of character come through because they're supposedly drunk, would seem to be a good reason. However, within the 90 minutes, that doesn't seem to me to be plausible.
Of course, it was written as a sort of contemporary play in 1987, or the last version of it in then, and now it's a sort of period piece.
I mean, that's the problem, I think, is that, you know, it's fine for the 1980s, and it's not irrelevant to now, because there's still materialistic greed. But I think because of the situation with America at the moment, it seems sort of irrelevant in a slightly petty way. You kind of think, well, that there are other things to say about America at the moment. And I think that makes the play seem less... It makes it seem a little bit out of date without being interestingly retro to me.
I don't know. I sort of thought, oddly, the play seemed timely in a way that perhaps even Kevin Spacey doesn't realize, in that, I mean, for heaven's sake, under George Bush Mark II, you know, this terrible fear of the outsider. Nobody wants the unknown entering their living room. God knows the blue collar is not in any way admired or valued by, you know, the government that is in power at the moment.
Although the blue collar elected it. But.
Yes, but that's another story. So it seemed to me to have a kind of odd timelessness, although that's to make grandiose claims that the play doesn't really deserve. But I do think it's a very good production with a terrific cast, not just Spacey. The other two are very good as well.
Actually, I think the other two are slightly better. I mean, I think he's very good and always is, but he just fractionally milks the kind of poignant bits, which they never do.
The other two being Stephen Webber, late of the producers on Broadway, where he played Leo Bloom, and also Mary Stuart Masterson, who late of Nine on Broadway, both of them musical actors in quite musical performances.
Yes, I mean, I think that they're very well calibrated. Grindley pushes them very hard, as I think he should. You know, you get very, very big performances. What's really impressive about, I agree, particularly Mary Stuart Masterson and Webber's performance, is that they are very big and they're very, very truthful. And that's quite hard, particularly, I think, for Mary Stuart Masterson, who has such a badly underwritten role.
Later in the year, the Old Vic, of course, are doing Richard II, with Trevor Nunn directing, which is where he just directed Hamlet earlier this year. And next up, The Philadelphia Story will star Kevin Spacey again, with Jennifer Ely just announced to co-star with him. Turning now to A Dream Play, have you seen the play before, Matt?
I have. I have dim memories of John Barton, I think it was, directing it at the RSC when I had just arrived in London. So it must have been around 1984 or 5, in the pit, with possibly Penny Downey. But don't ask me too much about it. I'm sure it was more faithful to the text than this production, but I don't in any way mean that as a criticism. I thought one of the things that was extraordinary about this production, which I thought was a pretty thorough revelation, was its sense of liberation, you know, both as text and as experience.
How different is this text, in fact, from the original play?
Well, I'm sorry, you're looking at the wrong person here, because I am neither a Strindberg expert or indeed any kind of expert on this play in particular. A play I have not seen, I have read about, and I'm very aware that the published text carefully delineates the fact that this is a version by Carol Churchill of the original play. This is a version of that version, with, as you said in the introduction, a lot of rehearsal games and experiments being interpolated into the text. However, as Matt said, I don't see that as a problem at all. I think it is a production of enormous sophistication. It's not flawless, but it is fascinating.
Are you all familiar with the text,
Kate? Yes, a bit. I mean, it's kind of interesting, the stages it's gone through of transmogrification. I mean, you can go back and back. So Katie Mitchell has worked with her actors, quite radically changing the text that Carol Churchill has supplied. And so it's the Katie Mitchell version is much more kind of actor's dream. So there's kind of, you know, suddenly the main character finds himself in the middle of a ballet or having to audition. So there's all that interpolated. And then if you go back to Carol Churchill's text, she's actually much closer to Strindberg. And in the actual product we get, the character is a stockbroker or a broker. In Carol Churchill's text, he's still an officer, as in a kind of soldier. And that's true to Strindberg. But even Carol Churchill has cut a lot of... There's a sort of Buddhist, pseudo-Buddhist prologue in the Strindberg where Indra's daughter comes down from heaven to watch mankind's woes, and that's completely axed from the Churchill. So we're many steps away, but actually if you look back at the Carol Churchill text, it's much closer to the original.
I think that there's a sense that in some quarters... Katie Mitchell is regarded as a very willful director, and my jury has long been out on her. I see some of her work and think it's absolutely magnificent, and other stuff I find deeply self-indulgent. I think what's very interesting about this production is that she talks in a programme note about the fact that Strindberg was, to a greater extent, trying to stage a dream and was working at the absolute limits of what theatrical form would allow, and therefore if you're going to do it in 2005, honouring a vision that is stuck wholly in 1901 seems to be slightly absurd, and I do think that given that all over the material it does announce that this is a version of a version, that you can that sort of liberates her and allows her to get away with what in other circumstances would probably be murder.
But this is perhaps a play like Wojciech that's a kind of a blank canvas on which a director can project their own vision and version.
I think that's actually a very good comparison, Wojciech, because there are certain plays which are sort of trampolines on top of which directors can do their thing. Mm. And I thought what's fascinating about this is very often when one's charting the growth of an actor's career, you kind of wait for that moment where they break through. And I have sort of been on the fence about Katie Mitchell up until Three Sisters, which I absolutely loved, and I've liked her since then a lot. But I thought with this it was as if it was sort of her complete statement to date, and that was really thrilling to see, for me anyway, to see a director who's absolutely arrived, not least at a kind of playfulness and wit, which she didn't used to have. Her stuff used to be very serious and
earnest,
kind of self-regarding, and it's gotten much more exuberant and witty.
One of the causes that perhaps is the choreography and physical theatre that they use. I mean, apparently actors train daily in ballet and ballroom dancing. She said in her programme that both are referred to in the play, and I wanted the dance and movement culture of the production to emerge from these dance forms.
I do think that's a really powerful point. The woman sitting next to me on press night was clearly not up for this. She was really irritated. I mean, you know, what we haven't done is explain that, you know, there's very little dialogue in this production. It is absolutely a kind of a series of interlocking dreams in which fantastic things happen with the fluidity of a dream, with the absurdity of a dream, and as Matt says, with the wit and humour of a dream. It is a piece of extraordinary choreography. I think if you go and see it and watch it as dance, it makes complete and utter sense. If you sit there looking for a beginning, a middle, and an end, and for sort of causal reality and logical progressions, then you'll end up being deeply frustrated because it doesn't supply that. But then that's a bit like looking at a dream and going, well,
why does that fish turn into a bicycle? Well, because it's a dream is the answer.
Of course, this is an ensemble that Katie Mitchell has actually forged. She's worked with these people, most of them, all before.
Quite a bit,
and that's
yeah.
a fascinating development.
To me, I think it's quite interesting that actually, I think this version has more clarity than the original. I mean, the original is more sort of mad and fragmented. And what she does is essentially she kind of frames it. So there's a guy who falls asleep and is dreaming, and then there are dreams within dreams, but it's essentially his dream, which is less clear in the original Strindberg. And it's a little bit like, it's got the illogic and fragmentariness of a dream still, but it's also got an element of a detective plot. So you kind of gradually, by his weird dreams, work out what's happened to him in real life, which is his mother died when he was young. Maybe something nasty happened to his brother, maybe he did something to his brother, you're not quite sure, but something went on. And then he's lost two wives in either divorce or gone off with another man, or he's been awful to them, or... And so you kind of piece that together, and I think there's a stronger storyline as a consequence than actually in the more radically weird Strindberg. You kind of trace a story through.
It's also one of those rare productions which does what I think a lot of theatre aspires to doing, which rarely achieves, which is exploit the theatricality of the space. I mean, there's so much lip service paid in that dreaded phrase, the avant-garde, to kind of refashioning theatre. This actually does, without in any way claiming that it's avant-garde, but it's much more revelatory to me than recent pieces by Richard Foreman or even Peter Sellers. And maybe Katie Mitchell has sort of trumped them at their own game. The stage is absolutely alive. It's also incredibly sensual. There are certain images that are just breathtaking. You want to kind of take them home.
I do think we should talk a bit about the design. Vicky Mortimer's design is really, really... It's sort of creamy greys and cream, and people seem to float in and out of it because... Kate Flatt's choreography. There is just this wonderful sense of movement and the play of light. There's a back wall. We seem to be in this sort of Swedish interior, domestic interior. There's a back wall that sort of hoves in and out of view, and it's got glass windows in, and we see events mistily going on in the background, and there's sort of corridors created within this space, and bits of furniture whisk in and out, and desks rock and suddenly seem to turn into ships at sea. It is extraordinarily imaginative, but I think the strength of the design is that it does a very little amount of work, but makes you, the audience, do an awful lot more. It's like applying jump leads to audience's imagination. It really creates a word. Somebody used the word trampoline earlier. There's a kind of springboard going on. This production sets up an idea, and you then run with it.
I mean, I think that's right. I think there are some absolutely wonderful images. I also think we could talk about the sound. There's a kind of fantastic sound score, which is sometimes just noises. So it starts off in an office setting, a sort of rather dimly lit 1950s office. And there's kind of... On one level, it's very serene and quiet. And then at other moments, there's this kind of... Which is very like a dream, that sort of calm, stroke, anxious feeling. And there's sort of suddenly there's clocks ticking and typewriters and alarm bells going off. And there's also beautiful music. She uses great music, and there's a Schubert song that comes in. It's just extraordinary kind of point where it comes in, and you'd never have really thought of putting it in, but when it's there, it's fantastic. And there's also, I mean, particularly in images, there's one where his mother, who died when he was young, he's kind of watching her in the dream and turns into the little boy again. And she's washing her hair in a bowl, and she's kind of suicidal mother, and she's kind of drowning her hair. And it's this wonderful image, and almost in slow motion, it's almost an iconic image.
It's interesting how we're noticing soundscape a lot more nowadays, Feston notably as well. But the other thing is that this is a collaboration with the Tate Modern, and have any of us been down to the Tate Modern to see Strindberg's
not
art?
Not yet.
Sadly,
no.
Not yet.
But that's a unique thing to show Strindberg's art.
I think his pictures are kind of interestingly expressionistic. You can see the kind of madness coming out as he paints a landscape, sort of like an extreme version of Van Gogh.
You know, the effect of this on me was really odd. I left it and I wanted to go right back in and see it again.
And that doesn't happen much, I can tell you that.
It really grew on me. I mean, I thought the start was quite wobbly and that some of the humour at the start didn't work, but I think you become absorbed. It also has a dreamlike power on you.
It has that kind of slowed down rhythm, which at first I think is disconcerting, but actually it's like being dragged underwater. You sort of pick up on what's going on and it begins to really work upon you.
And finally on to Days of Wine and Roses, the Donmar Warehouse. Have you seen the film, Kate?
I have seen the film with Jack Lemmon and Lee Remick.
How different is this?
Quite radically rewritten in terms of the dialogue. So Owen McCafferty has written this version of the original film script. So a lot of the dialogue is different. The basic plot is the same. But what he's also done is it's a two-hander in this version. So, you know, there are no party scenes, there are no extra characters, which I actually had a problem with, because I felt in this version the two Irish people come over and get married and live in London. And it's really about sort of isolation within the city, because of the drinking problem gradually kind of isolates particularly the woman. And yet they started off because it was a sort of social drinking thing with each other and with him at work. And you just don't see any of the social side of it or the city side of it, which I sort of had a problem with, because it just seemed like they could have been on a desert island.
The social side is referred to a lot, though. Yes. They talk about the friends that are coming around and the walks on Westminster Bridge and so on.
Yes, I mean, oddly, for a play with only two characters, I felt as if I sort of knew everyone else by the end of the play, including the people across the way who take in their young son, Kieran, who seems to spend less and less time with his parents as the show goes on. The reviews of this have been very interestingly mixed, but I quite liked it, and I was surprised at how much I liked it, largely because it sort of circumvents a lot of the cliches of this kind of scenario. There was very little sort of slurred drunken acting, for instance, and I have to say Peter MacDonald I thought was extraordinary. I mean, he has that kind of emotional translucence that, you know, really great performances have. Anne-Marie Duff, good, but not quite as much from the inside out, but I still thought it was quite rewarding.
I think that I would just leap in and speak of Anne-Marie Duff, who I think does an extraordinary trick. It's a really great production by Peter Gill, who is really meticulous, and within a production that allows the actors to do everything, you see them change costume. She appears to age across the 6 to 8 years of this production by doing almost nothing. She occasionally has her hair differently. I think it's really rather a major performance. It doesn't have the same wounded quality that MacDonald's got, but I think they bounce off each other to an extraordinary degree.
I usually find Peter Gill a director second to none in kind of animating social detail, and yet somehow on the wide expanse of the Donmar Warehouse, this production didn't get me. Funnily enough, I went home afterwards and read the play, and I thought the play was extraordinarily beautiful, but I didn't register that in the theatre until the very last scene, when I was finally moved right at the end.
I think that there is a restraint about this production, which I personally am all in favour of. I'm sort of echoing what Matt was saying here, in that I am deeply and abidingly allergic to drunk dramas, basically. You know, there are dozens, Leaving Las Vegas, the one that springs to mind. There are so many of these plays which give you a finger-wagging version of the horrors and terrors of alcohol, and you just get a bunch of actors being riotously self-indulgent. And whilst I admire the 1962 Blake Edwards film version with those two actors we mentioned, there is a scene in the greenhouse where Jack Lemmon goes completely wild on drink, which is, you know, it's barnstorming drunk acting, and you never get that in this. And I think that partly explains why some people feel slightly removed from this, because you sort of expect to see really Oscar-grabbing type drunk acting, which this doesn't give. And I think it does, however, pack a punch. But as you say, it only really hits you at the end, because you sort of, it takes you on a journey. You're not allowed to stand back and go, good heavens, that's really moving. You're actually in it much further than you think you are.
I'm not nearly as keen as everyone else on this play. I mean, I actually think Anne-Marie Duff is fantastic, and I found her magnetic and watched her almost all the time. I actually found Peter MacDonald less riveting. And I think that's partly because in this version he's made into a bookie, and he has a passion for horse racing. And there's this sort of allegory about Irishness where there's a horse called Arkell who really existed, who was a kind of meteoric and then a meteoric and then got injured, which is sort of like, you know, he's a fast-rising bookie and then their life is destroyed by alcohol. But he just has these enormously long speeches about horse racing, which I found really boring. And actually, he did them like a sports commentator, and Peter Gill sort of shoved in some, I didn't think very meticulously, actually. I normally love Peter Gill. Sort of put in some soundtrack of, you know, racing to try and soup up this long monologue, and I just found them incredibly boring.
Oh, I couldn't disagree more. I thought what was remarkable about Peter MacDonald's performance was the quality of rapture, and from the first scene where you see him in Belfast Airport, and he's just a wonderful sort of open-faced, eager enthusiast for everything, for the new experience that London might bring, for this new woman, Mona and Marie Duff, whom he's just met, for his beloved Arkell. I think the writing of the Arkell section is quite treacly, actually, and there was one cringe-making speech near the end, but I thought that actually Peter MacDonald wrote it out quite deftly.
I mean, I think he did. I think you're right. I think he wrote it out, but I just don't really understand why those speeches are so long. And
I've already read somewhere that they'll make great audition speeches.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, I do think that perhaps this is slightly straining at the leash, he said, mixing metaphors like that. And I can see what McCafferty's doing. And it's interesting that Alison Chitty's design absolutely leaves them marooned in space. There's this sort of grey cream set, and you have the paint bridge on the back wall making Westminster Bridge. But basically, it is figures marooned in space in a way that these people come over from Belfast. They are marooned in London. And the fact that you don't see their lives, you don't see them at work, you don't see their friends, but they are conjured up, does give you a sense of their complete isolation, which leads to their, partially to their addiction. But it's, I'm not sure how strongly the metaphor finally does work. I am second to none in my admiration for Owen McCafferty. I thought Scenes from the Big Picture, his previous play, which has since won 3 playwriting awards, was one of the best things I have ever seen, and it was an astonishing piece of writing. And I think that this has more than its moments, but I'm not sure that he's managed to pull off the fact that he's trying to write a love story about two people who are stranded away from home and what that means. I think mapping that onto the original Days of Wine and Roses doesn't quite work.
I mean, Scenes from a Big Picture was 40 scenes and 21 actors, and you got a full sense throughout of what was going on at any one time. Here we have 2 actors, 9 scenes, and the passage of time is really only done... You'd have to follow the script to work out exactly what year and how many years have passed.
Yeah. It's very cleverly done, though, with these sort of musical or snatches of music, a sort
that
of
was
montage.
Oh, it's just like, you know, they just put in some topical songs.
No, I like that a lot, because it was sort of fractured as the years were fractured. And then when there was one bit, which was the scene following on from the one before, it was a sort of sustained piece of music. So it was as if, you know, you were getting the time compressed in these little intervals.
Right. I suppose. For me, actually, talking about Scenes from the Big Picture, he also did a play called Closing Time, which was
set in a pub.
And I actually, because that was kind of an orchestration of an entire sort of micro community, and I thought that was absolutely beautifully done. And in a way, this felt... I mean, I know it's all deliberate, and I think Peter Gill's production was deliberately kind of isolated and quiet, but it seemed to me that he'd actually done something richer and more interesting in Closing Time, and this was a rather smaller piece, not... I mean, I thought their one-to-one relationship was beautifully portrayed, and actually their kind of physicality and their tenderness and their teasingness was beautiful. But I actually thought it was a rather small piece. It felt almost like an earlier piece of work to me.
And there I think we shall have to leave it. Thank you, Matt, David, and Kate.